And I'm not the least bit surprised that there's so much interest in her appearance here today. Next up, just so you know, is Senator Dodd, and that will be on April 28th, and then Senator Hatch, and that will be on May 7th. As you know, the hosts, the three of us, don't say very much at these events because they are for our guests. I will simply introduce this morning's event by saying two things. One is, as a health policy person, I just can't resist saying that whatever happens with health reform this year, there's just no question but that Nancy Ann is one of the most respected people in our field, and I don't know a single major player who wasn't happy, if not thrilled, when they learned the news that she'd taken on this critical post. And the second thing I want to do is just to underscore the importance of the debate that we will have this year and of the assignment that Nancy Ann has taken on by showing you this semi-serious chart I've been working on for some upcoming speeches that I've been doing in about 2 seconds. This shows you in the yellow that there have been four major moments of opportunity for health reform since Harry Truman, including Wilbur Mills and Fannie Fox falling in the reflecting pool. And here's my take-home number. Hold on a second. I could have, yes, but you see why I didn't in a moment. And here's my take-home number for today, not to put any pressure on Nancy Ann, but simply to underscore the importance of the moment and also the importance of the assignment that she has taken on for the president. The average time between major national health reform windows since Truman, 19.7 years. So if it doesn't happen now, we may have to wait a while. With that, let me turn the program over to one of our two partners here, to Dan.
You go.
And then to Ron, who will introduce Nancy Ann. She'll make whatever remarks she chooses to make, and we'll open it up for your questions. We also have, I should mention, a good many journalists on the phone here today who are in listen mode only, and you remember how this works. The reporters in the room will ask the questions. So that's our plan for today.
I'm Dan Danner with NFIB. Let me say a couple things before Ron's going to officially introduce Nancy Ann. As we've mentioned at each of these, we do think that small business is key to the healthcare debate. Small business is about half of all the jobs in America, about half of GDP. But they're also small business owners. Their employees and families are about half of all the uninsured. So we really believe that small business is a key component of any healthcare reform. I did have the great pleasure of meeting the other day with Nancy Ann, and do want to say we really look forward to working together to find a solution that works for small business.
Hi, and I'm Ron Pollack, Executive Director of Families USA, the National Organization for Healthcare Consumers. I was going to go launch right into the introduction of Nancy Ann, but with Drew's slide, it does remind me of something. I'm an optimist. We are going to pass meaningful health care reform, and I'm looking forward to all of us being in the Rose Garden when the president signs it. There are some cynics in this town. Of course, nobody in this room is a cynic. One cynic likens health care reform to a cicada. It comes out every 17 years or so. It makes a lot of noise and then goes away. I think we're going to see a very different phenomenon with Nancy Ann's leadership. For those of you who don't know Nancy Ann, you're in for a real treat. All of us who care about health care reform truly rejoiced when Nancy Ann was selected by the president to be counselor and director of the White House Office of Healthcare Reform. She has an illustrious history and background in healthcare. She served in 1997 to 2000 as the administrator of the Healthcare Financing Administration. Many of you now know it as the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. where she ran Medicare, Medicaid, and the CHIP program for children. She served as the Associate Director for Health and Personnel at the White House Office of Management and Budget. She served in the cabinet of Tennessee Governor Ned McWhorter as Commissioner of Health Services. She's been a commissioner of the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, and she's had a distinguished career in the private sector as well. She was a fellow at the Institute of Politics at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government, a senior fellow at the Wharton School. She's a board member of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Nancy Ann really brings a lot of background and knowledge to her task, so we're all thrilled that she was willing to join us here today.
Thank you. Well, I don't know about cicadas and Fanny Fox, but I'm here to tell you that we're making a lot of progress in realizing the president's goal of getting health reform enacted this year. One reason, I think, is that all the groups who were on different sides of the table 15 years ago are now at the same table working together and talking about how we can reach these goals. We've got not only NFIB, and I'm happy that Dan is here this morning, who's been very open and willing to work with us, but also the unions, the Federation of American Hospitals, the AHA, Families USA, Ron. And what I found remarkable is that no one wants the status quo. They don't start off talking about their position. They talk about how do we get everyone covered, how do we lower costs for businesses and families. And that's coming not only from the groups that are like Ron's group, Families USA, which is more of a consumer group, but it's coming from the providers themselves. They understand that healthcare costs are out of control and something that we have to get a hold of. The president's made clear, and you all have heard him, that he intends to get healthcare reform done this year. And unlike the effort 15 years ago, Congress has put its money where its mouth is, and it's already enacted a budget resolution that has healthcare reform, the healthcare reserve fund, in the budget. So if you look back, I think Drew's chart this morning was instructive. If you look back 15 years ago at where we were at this exact time in the Clinton administration, we're in a very different place. The administration's vigorously engaged with members of Congress as they work to draft legislation that's consistent with the president's blueprint and principles. And remember, they're starting in both the House and the Senate from the president's blueprint that he set out in the campaign and talked about for 2 years. Since I've been there, which is about a month now, I've met one-on-one with more than 40 members of Congress, both Democrats and Republicans. I have worked with many of them before in the past in my career, and I've found that on both sides of the aisle, they're in agreement with the president's principles. While they don't agree on every single point in his plan, they are all saying that they want to work with us constructively. And my experience in working with them has been that that's the case, that they've been more than willing to meet me halfway in the past, and I'm sure they're going to be able to this time as well. That's another way, I think, in which the process this year is very different from 15 years ago. That time, by the late summer and by early fall of 93, there were probably a dozen or more bills in the Congress, healthcare reform bills of one sort or another. But there wasn't really the kind of engagement that we see this year on the part of the committee chairs or staff working on a bill. It just wasn't the same thing. In fact, as you'll recall, in the Senate Finance Committee, which is a lead committee of jurisdiction here, the chairman did not agree that healthcare reform was a priority and wasn't particularly interested in moving forward on it, wanted to work on welfare reform and some other issues. By the time President Clinton sent a fully written bill, 1,400 pages or so, up to Congress, it was, I think, October or so of 1993. This time around, it's only April, and the difference is that the cicadas, Ron, are committee staff busily working away and engaged in the mechanics of sorting through technical aspects of bills and drafting specs and actual bill language. You may think this is a congressional recess this last 2 weeks and that folks are on spring break, but in fact, if you've been up to the Congress, you know that the committee staff members who work on these issues are meeting, they're working in their offices, they're you know, very engaged in drafting specifications and looking at numbers and things like that. And the administration is providing them with what I'll call active technical assistance and guidance. We're meeting with them virtually every day. We're talking to them on the phone. They're working on the weekends. I mean, this is very active work that's going on. In the Senate, there are two committees of jurisdiction, the Help Committee and Finance, and they both are on track, and I think they expect to be on the floor with bills by the summer. In the House, there are three committees of jurisdiction, and we're seeing something that we've never seen before, which is that those three committees are working to report very similar or the same chairman's mark soon after the Senate acts, and I expect that to be around the August recess. It's been, so far, a remarkably harmonious process for that many committees and that many staffs to work together. They're deeply steeped in the details. You know that Senator Baucus has held more than 20 hearings in the last couple of years on various aspects of reform. You know that Senator Kennedy has, for the past year, been convening in his office meetings of stakeholders. I know Dan's participated in those, as has Ron. They've devoted a lot of time to meeting twice a week for hours with some strange bedfellows to working through towards some consensus on some issues. So these people have worked together for years, and they're professionals, and they want to get this done, and that's what I'm seeing on the part of the staffs up on the Hill. As for me, I've been spending about 60 to 75% of my time with the staffs or members of Congress. Some of you have reached out and wanted to come in and talk to us about what the process is or what we're doing, and one reason I'm not there is because I'm often up on the Hill. The other place I've been spending my time is with business, labor, the AMA, the AHA, the NFIB, various groups who I've reached out to or who've reached out to me to talk about how we get this done this year. And I've also spent some time out on the road. The White House, as you know, kicked off this effort with the President hosting a forum on healthcare reform where we had more than 50 members of Congress as well as representatives of a lot of the groups to come in and talk to us about this. And it's very different than these kinds of things in the past. This was not just a speech from the President to everyone assembled and they all politely filed out. This time we asked them to break into groups and spend 2 hours around the table hashing through how do we lower costs, how do we get everyone covered. And, you know, I held my breath during some of those discussions because I wasn't sure what would come out, but a lot of, I think you'd have to admit a lot of progress has been made. And then I've been to Des Moines, to Burlington, Vermont, and to Greensboro, North Carolina, to meet with Republican and Democratic governors and have large publicly attended meetings with people who are interested in this subject. And I've been struck by the stories that I've heard. And Dan, you're right. A lot of them are from small business owners. A lot of them are from people who work for small business or who are newly laid off and who are struggling to afford insurance premiums, who have been, people have been denied coverage or have had steep increases in their premiums because of pre-existing conditions. The stories are heartbreaking, and I think they're the reason why this president, who spent the last 2 years out talking to the American people, has made clear that health reform must not wait, cannot wait, and will not wait another year. So I'm happy to try to entertain some questions now, Drew.
Great. Wonderful. Thank you. For the cameras, we may very well know who all of you are, but if you just tell us who you are and where you're from, it'd be very helpful. And let us start with Mary Agnes right here.
Mary Agnes Carey with Kaiser Health News. I have a question for you about financing of healthcare reform. It seems like changing the current treatment of tax benefits, thank you, so the current tax treatment of health benefits, rather, is a must-have to finance healthcare reform. Do you agree with that? Do you think it'll be in the bills on Capitol Hill? And what other financing mechanisms do you see coming forth?
Well, first, the President, in his budget, put forward his commitment to get health care reform done this year, and he did it in the form of a health care reserve fund, a $634 billion fund that is a down payment and a placeholder for working with Congress on the details of what the reform bill will look like. And as I said, the Congress has already put its money where its mouth is by saying, yes, that's in the budget. So that's the first step towards this. As far as the tax exclusion, remember that the President's plan is based on, he wants to build on the current system of employer-based coverage. And so he said for some time that he has serious concerns about any kind of financing that's built on dealing with that tax exclusion or somehow undermining it. He's very skeptical of those plans, and he's been clear about that. That said, we're working with the Congress on how this will be financed, and a lot depends on, you know, the exact contours of the bill that they come up with.
Marilyn.
Thanks. Hi, Marilyn Serafini with National Journal. Nancy Ann, can you talk just a little bit about Medicare's financial situation and how that can and should be dealt with within the context of broader health care reform? President Obama has talked about it within the context of broader health care reform. Is the administration at this point seeing it as enough to the kinds of reforms being talked about, such as the bundling of payments, realigning of incentives? Is that enough to handle Medicare, or are we going to need to do more this year?
Well, first, when we talk about the twin goals here of lowering cost for American businesses and families, we're also talking about government. That's a piece of it, too. And then covering everyone. And those two goals are intertwined. They both need to be done. In the president's budget, as part of the financing for health care reform, he did lay out a set of proposals that are the next stage of reforms to the Medicare payment system, things like addressing the inequities in the Medicare Advantage program and the additional spending there by moving to a more competitive system of setting their payments, things like bundling of payments to get better incentives for hospitals to prevent readmissions so that they don't have an incentive to let people out early who haven't received all the care they need and then they come right back to the hospital. So those are truly, I think, Marilyn, payment reforms. They're not just the usual suspects in Medicare. And they would extend the solvency of the trust fund by at least 2 years. So they're a down payment on what needs to be done for Medicare. And remember also that we, during the budget window, health care reform is going to be deficit neutral. And outside of that, we expect to be proposing some things, and we're already doing some things that we think will have a big impact on Medicare and Medicaid long term. Things like comparative effectiveness, which were in the stimulus package in the Economic Recovery Act. So we're getting a start on providing clinicians and patients and plans with the information they need to really know which treatments are going to work best for which patients. That hasn't been out there before, and we expect that to have an impact long-term on the cost curve, bending the curve. The health information technology, which the Congressional Budget Office agreed would result in some savings to Medicare inside the budget window, but we think beyond that will also, that getting everyone with electronic medical records will help to prevent medical errors and will help to make sure that they get the right treatments. Prevention and wellness. So those things long-term we think will also help with the Medicare Trust Fund, and the president does want to strengthen it for the future.
Susan Jaffe from Health Affairs Journal. President Obama has talked about cutting the payments to Medicare Advantage, and that saying that will generate $177 billion, which he wants to take out of Medicare and use, if I understand it correctly, use it for to fund health care reform. Given what you know about the troubled past of Medicare Plus Choice, Medicare Advantage. How do you think that will work? Asking the plans to competitively bid, I don't think that's been done before. Is there a precedent, and how would it work?
Well, I don't want to get too deeply into the details of those proposals because that's not where I'm spending most of my time, but you're right. The president has proposed to move to a more competitive system, and it has been discussed in the past, and it would work. Essentially, the benchmarks that are set right now is what the plans will be bidding against. What we're trying to deal with here is everyone acknowledges that the Medicare Advantage plans, and particularly the private fee-for-service plans nationwide, have been paid something like a 12 to 14% premium above what traditional fee-for-service Medicare has been paid to provide the same services. So it's the next step to remove that additional payment that they're getting. And also, though, to move to having them bid and say, versus the benchmark, this is how much it would cost us to take care of these patients. And, you know, that's part of setting that up for the future, and I believe it starts in 2011 or so. So the details of it haven't been specified yet. But that is, when you say removing it from Medicare, in fact, the Medicare proposals in the budget are part of what extend the solvency of Medicare. So I don't think they're removing it from Medicare. In fact, they're strengthening Medicare by reducing overpayments.
Aliza Marcus, Bloomberg News. I wanted to ask you, how critical is the idea of a new public plan to President Obama's health idea? And would you, I mean, this is something Republicans say could be a deal breaker. And how do you envision a public plan?
Well, one thing that's been interesting to me is in going around on the Hill and talking about the various elements of the president's plan, and the public plan is one of those, is the fact that you have to sort of get on the same page about what a public plan is when you're talking about it. And it's been interesting to talk to people who say, oh, I don't like the idea of a public plan. When you actually start talking to them about what it might look like, you realize that you're talking about two different things. So I'm actually very hopeful that we'll be able to reach an agreement on that, because it is part of the president's plan. And the reason, if you've heard him talk about it, the reason it's included is because he wanted a mechanism to lower cost and to keep the private sector honest by having a competitive public plan in there. And as he said at the forum that he hosted at the White House, if there are other ways to do that, I'd be open to hearing them, but that's why I put it in my plan. And so that's why it's in there now. But it's been interesting to me in talking to members of Congress who have raised questions about it to learn that, you know, when you start using examples, actually people aren't so clear about what it is. And I guess, Aliza, the way I look at it is, if these are truly policy disagreements about what a public plan is, when you list those two goals of keeping costs lower, trying to lower costs, and keeping the private sector honest or competitive, everyone agrees with that. And there are policy ways of getting around some of the objections that people raise. So if that's what it is, I think we can work together and have a public plan that everyone could agree to. If it's a philosophical debate, then that may be another thing, and people may not be able to agree.
Hi, Chuck Lewis from Hearst. You say there are different definitions of a public plan. Could you give us your definition of a public plan?
Well, my definition is a public plan is something that's sponsored by the government and therefore has very low or almost non-existent administrative costs compared to others. It doesn't have the need to have brokers outselling. It wouldn't have the need to have a lot of cost and profits the way private plans would. So it has that advantage. It could operate by the same rules that all the other plans do. It could have payment rates that are very similar, or it could have payment rates that are the same as Medicare. That's one idea that's been used. So there are various ways of looking at it. And if you look at the marketplace right now, there are a number of examples. One example is there are state employee plans out there that some people would regard as public plans. They're sponsored by the government, but they have lower administrative costs. And so they tend to be less expensive, but they're often operated by private plans. So there's that model out there. There are other models. Medicare is obviously a model of a public plan. So there are different, there are different breeds of public plans that could be part of this. And I think, again, the goal is how do we make sure that within, we're talking about here the insurance pool or the exchange, how do we make sure that inside that exchange, the people who are shopping for a health insurance plan are looking at things that are low cost, and that they are competitive, and they have some choices. So I think that's what we're looking for.
I'm right-handed, and I've been unfair to the left side of the room. Yes.
Hi, I'm Emily Walker with MedPage Today. Yeah. You just said that there are some policy ways of getting around the disagreements over the public plan. Can you be a little more specific on that?
Well, when you sit down and talk to people, and they say, you know, one thing I have a problem with is I don't think I like this public plan idea. My response is, well, what don't you like? And one thing that's come back a couple times is, well, It'll be based on Medicare payment rates, and those are too low for providers now. Or even if they don't think they're too low, they're concerned that if more people choose a public plan, there'll be so many people in it, and if the payment rates are Medicare rates, that it would shift costs to the private sector. So it has to do with how you price the providers if there's a public plan. Well, if that's an issue, there are various ways of doing that. You don't have to use Medicare prices. You can use something else. I think they're responding to, there's some analysis out there that just because this is all beginning, they're making assumptions about what the payment rates would be and making assumptions about how many people would go into a public plan. And depending on which assumptions you use, you could decide, gee, I don't like this. But these are policy disagreements. Now, if it's a philosophical disagreement of, I just don't want the government offering a plan, that's a different thing, and that may be something that's harder to bridge. But I think if it's a policy disagreement, there are ways of bridging that gap.
Todd Leuenberg with Thompson Publishing. The fee-for-service system has been, you know, talked about as being responsible for a lot of overutilization, and I'm wondering what in the present Congress plan would be the fate of the fee-for-service system, which may be, you know, again, forfeited in favor of a system that either pays for quality or pays for outcomes. And it just seems to me that would be a rather difficult switch to make, and you might be susceptible to the same problems of waste and unnecessary care and so on. Could you talk about that pay system and how it might change?
Sure. The fee-for-service system is something that we want to strengthen. The president's budget does that. It proposes a number of changes to it to try to change the incentives. So I talked about one of them earlier, I hate to get into wonky talk, even with all of you health reporters here, but to bundle payments to hospitals to cover some of the post-acute care, things like home health, some nursing home care that people often get after hospitalization. And the reason to do that is to create more incentives for hospitals to make sure that people get the treatments they need when they're in the hospital and don't have to leave and then ping-pong back to the hospital, get readmitted, which is a terrible thing for patients and their families and also costly to the system. So those kinds of policy changes will help change the incentive that hospitals have right now under the current prospective payment system to just take care of them during the hospitalization and get them out as soon as possible. You know, make sure they get the right treatments when they're in there. So no, we're not. Everything that we're doing, if you talk about health information technology, for example, that assumes a robust private system and a robust fee-for-service system. And we want to incentivize physicians to use electronic medical records in a meaningful way for better treatment, better care, more convenience, better administration in their offices. That's building on the strengths of the private system, the fee-for-service system, and trying to make it better. And this will be something it's dynamic. We'll have to keep doing it. It's not like you have a silver bullet here and we solve everything, but we want to move towards these things that will bend the curve and create better incentives for physicians and hospitals to treat patients in a smarter way.
In the back.
Hi, Lester Baker Clown.
Not so well.
Okay, there we go. Lester Fader with The Nation. Nancy, you made a point, excuse me, of talking about the reserve fund being in the budgets. And, of course, the president asked for a dollar number, and neither the House nor the Senate provided a dollar figure for that fund. And I'm wondering why that looks like something that was a victory, as you were saying, and not as a sign that the amount of paying for universal coverage is going to continue to be a stumbling block. And even if we do get everybody covered, that you're not going to be able to pay for sufficient benefits to have that be meaningful.
Of all the things I worry about, that's not one of them. The reserve fund being in the budget is a huge victory, I think. And for those of you who follow the way budgets are done, the fact that there isn't a number in there isn't what's dispositive. What is dispositive to me and what is meaningful to me is that the Congress said, we want to do health care reform this year, and they included a reserve fund in there. And then, obviously, we have to work out the details of exactly what the number will be. It'll be based on the plans that they come up with. You know, they're starting from the president's plan, so we're working together on that, and I think we'll be in concert. And I think the kind of benefits they're talking about are going to be just fine.
Great job. A lot of questions and answers, yes.
Hi, I'm just wondering how the medical home concept fits into all these plans. This is sort of like a big buzzword among doctors.
It is a buzzword, and this relates to the other question I got about fee-for-service. How do you improve that and strengthen it? And the idea there, and it's been talked about, it's actually something that we began work on when I was at HCFA 10 years ago, is to try to create for patients a less fragmented experience, so that there's someone managing their care, and, you know, the idea is that it might be a primary care physician or clinician, a health professional, would help to make sure that the transitions between care are managed, that they're getting the right medications, that they have a place to go. Right now in fee-for-service, for all of its strengths, one of the problems is if you're a senior, for example, in fee-for-service Medicare, yes, you have a lot of choice, but you could be referring yourself to a specialist and back and forth, and they don't have often medical records, so they don't know what you're getting or whether you're getting the right medications. I mean, Ron and I have talked about this, and there's, you know, legions of stories of people who are just going back and forth in the system. The idea would be to have a more centralized place or a person they could look to, a health professional, who would be helping them to manage their care. And yes, that's a part. There are demonstrations, very robust demonstrations going on of this right now. And in the private sector, some insurance companies are doing this already, and they've shown real promise, and we hope to move forward with that in Medicare.
So it would remain a priority to incentivize the medical home concept, both for specialists and primary care physicians?
Well, I don't know the details of how specialists would fit into it, but I know that the idea is to make sure that patients, this is centered on patients, to make sure that they are getting the care that they need when they need it, and to help them manage that and to help them, you know, understand the importance of being compliant with their medications and those sorts of things. And so I think more likely it would be a primary care clinician of some sort who would be helping to manage that and helping to decide which specialists need to be seen or when they need to see them.
Don't forget to help us by telling us who you are and where you're from. You've been trying for a very long time.
David Hochberg, Investors Business Daily. I wanted to ask you about budget reconciliation. The House has included health care reform and reconciliation. The Senate has not. My understanding is they're going to try to resolve that next week. Since including health care reform would be make it easier to pass, will President Obama push to see it included in the budget resolution?
Well, the President, when he talked to me, made clear to me that my job was to go up and work with both parties and work with both Democrats and Republicans in trying to get this done this year, and that's what I've been doing. So we'd like to see this be a bipartisan bill. Certainly when I talk to Republicans, many of them say, well, all of them say they agree with what we're trying to do, and they have said they want to be constructive and work with us, and that's what we hope will happen.
Another group.
Hi, Drew Armstrong from Congressional Quarterly. Drew Armstrong from Congressional Quarterly. Just following up on that, Senator Daschle, when he came up for his hearings and meetings with members on the Hill, said he did not want to use reconciliation when he was going to be having your current job. When Governor Sebelius came up, she said she wanted to keep it on the table. The administration seems to be pushing towards the position of using it. Can you just explain then why, you know, in January the administration was talking about not using this, the reconciliation process, and now it seems to be increasingly on the table, or at least being pushed for as an option? I think some of us are just trying to figure out where exactly the administration is on this, since it is such a big issue.
Well, remember, it's Congress who's working on the budget resolution right now, and so it's really for them to comment on that. But I'll tell you, as I just said to the previous questioner, president told me that my job is to go up and work with both Democrats and Republicans to try to get this done this year, and that's what we want to do. And both parties have used reconciliation from time to time. The Republicans certainly used it. It's not our preferred method, but I'm working with the Congress on both sides of the aisle to try to get this done this year, and I'm hopeful that we'll have Republicans supporting it.
John Reichard with Congressional Quarterly. Just going back to the insurance exchange controversy, I'm wondering if the administration would be willing to live with an insurance exchange organized by the government but offering only private plans.
John, you're telling me you're making news here because I didn't know there was an insurance exchange controversy.
Oh, well, there is one.
Well, what John's referring to is the president's plan and many plans that have been discussed over the last decade or so have talked about having a way of pooling risk so that small businesses and individuals could purchase coverage more easily and putting people together. And that's what the Massachusetts plan is based on. In fact, they have two or three exchanges, I think. So your question is whether we could live with a...
Well, I'm really... Maybe I used the word insurance exchange or the words inaccurately. I'm really talking about a public program that would be government or public in the sense that it's government organized but offering only private plans. Would that be acceptable to the administration as a public program?
I'm not sure I follow you. Are you asking?
In other words, like FEE, for example, or state employee programs that Governor Sebelius in her confirmation hearing talked about, those do not have on their menu of plans a government plan per se. They have Blue Cross Blue Shield or other private insurance options. So the menu is simply private insurance plans. So I'm wondering if that kind of a model would be acceptable to the Obama administration.
I'm sorry, but I'm not sure. I think you're not really talking about the insurance exchange. I think you're talking about the public plan again.
Right. That's
so.
Right.
You're asking whether...
Public plan rather than
well, that idea hasn't come up yet. You know, the president's plan talked about a public plan, and we were... I think what was contemplated was one that would be, a government-sponsored plan. We're working with the Congress on details of this, and I really don't know where they're going to come out. There'll probably be some give and take on it, but... He said all along that he'd be open to a model that lowers costs and has competition and choice to keep the private sector honest. So I'm not sure. This, I guess, is part of what I was saying when I said one of the interesting things has been talking to people about the public plan and trying to make sure we're talking about the same thing. So I think we need to maybe take this offline because I'm not sure I completely follow your question.
The question and the answer.
I think
all
so.
I think it's Karen.
Carrie Budoff Brown with Politico. Yeah, I just wanted to get a little bit more information or get more insight in terms of your interactions with Congress. You talked about providing technical assistance. You're on the Hill 75% of the time. What, you know, how engaged are you and what is the technical assistance or advice that the White House is providing right now to Congress? If you could just kind of break down the balance of power, for lack of a better word, in terms of how this is playing out, in terms of negotiating a bill?
Balance of power. Well, I think of it as like a team, and we're working together with them as a team. So we spend time talking to them about ideas like the insurance exchange John brought up, or I thought he was bringing up. It turns out it was kind of a different question. But what does that look like? And they have very specific questions. They're engaged in drafting specs for bills and in some cases language. So how does Massachusetts work? They've talked to people in Massachusetts. We've talked to people in Massachusetts. You know, they have three exchanges. Is that really necessary or would it be better to have one? You know, things like that. And we're, spend hours talking to them about those kinds of issues and giving them our feedback, guidance, reactions, in some cases presenting to them on what we've thought about, in other cases responding to things they've thought about. So it's a very active give and take, back and forth, mostly with staff, sometimes with members.
Is it just you or do you have a team of folks from the
there's a team of people in the administration who are working on this. Well, there are people at HHS, there are people within the White House, at OMB, and the NEC. It's a small group of people, and it's a small group of people on the Hill who are working on it.
Jill Wexler with Managed Healthcare Executive Magazine. In discussing the public plan option, there's also been talk about that applying to Part D, the Medicare drug benefit. And I'm wondering if you're looking at more competition in offering the drug benefit or other changes that would have the government more involved in how that plan is organized and how prices are set.
I don't have any information about that. I haven't heard. Again, you're ahead of me in hearing talk, because I haven't heard talk about Part D in that and a public plan. I don't have any specifics on that. Remember, I'm not running the Medicare program anymore. You may be thinking of me in my previous incarnation.
Craig, let's get the mic over here.
Yes, Stephen Langell with Roll Call. I was just wondering, if the president was presented with legislation that had no public plan option, if that was what he needed to take to sign a bill into law, would he be willing to do it?
You guys are really interested in the public plan, aren't you? Well, again, I'd answer this the way the president did, which is that he has a couple of goals when he put the public plan in his plan when he was running for president, and that was he wanted to make sure that he could keep costs low, and the public plan is one way of doing that. And he wanted to make sure there was competition and choice for consumers, and that you have a way of keeping private plans honest. But as he said, if there are other ways of doing that, he'd be open to talking about them.
I see, because there was mentioned yesterday at the World Health Congress, or this other event by Dora Hughes, that there are 8 principles that he values in a healthcare reform bill, and those are first and foremost. And if it was necessary to sign a bill into law, it didn't have a public plan, but it met those principles, then that would not be a vetoable offense. That would not be something where he would turn the bill away. I mean, is that accurate?
Well, I would never get into talking about vetoes, ever. So we're not talking about that. But as I understand it, that isn't what Dr. Hughes said. And in any event, I've given you the answer that the president has to this, which is that he included the public plan in his plan because he wanted to make sure costs could be lowered. He wanted to make sure there'd be competition and choice for consumers. And that's where we are, and that's what we're working with Congress on.
Let's see if the NewsHour has a question about a public plan.
Surely.
I'm wondering if you can give us any further philosophy or intelligence about how you see this being paid for. We've talked about some of the tax proposals from the president that have run into opposition. You didn't rule out, but seems skeptical about the idea of changing tax deductibility. So where do you see the shapes of a compromise on paying for it? And I also wanted to follow up on the question of Massachusetts. When you see what's happening with costs there, and you say you're looking at Massachusetts, does that raise some concerns for you about containing costs?
We have been looking at Massachusetts, and it's not – the evidence about cost is sort of mixed. I mean, it's been interesting – they say that for the first time, I think, the premiums aren't going up, and they think they've gotten some control over it. But as you say, they're also looking at ways to control costs, and some people say they should have done that earlier. You know, that said, in talking to some providers up there, their position is that getting everyone covered is what brought them all to the table to talk seriously about constraining costs. So it's interesting and instructive, and we are looking at that carefully. As far as how do we pay for this? Look, there's, you know, the president made clear that within the budget window, the 10-year budget window, this will be deficit neutral. And frankly, I've been talking about the budget resolutions, and they both say that too. So we're all in agreement. We in the Congress are in agreement that we want to pay for this within the budget window. Outside the budget window, we've talked about the various things that we call game changers that will, over time, begin to bend the cost curve. So those are things like the d- dispersion of health information technology, which the Congressional Budget Office in the Economic Recovery Act said would result in savings to the Medicare and Medicaid programs. They scored $12 billion in savings to federal programs. They also said that there would be savings to the private sector. Those haven't been scored, if you will. We haven't taken account of those yet, but I expect they would be in a health care reform package because they'll be things that will bend the cost curve over time. Prevention and wellness. We made a $1 billion investment in the Economic Recovery Act in that. We expect that to show dividends to the private sector. When you look at how much healthcare spending has been increasing and the percentage of GDP it is and where it is in relationship to the rest of growth in the economy, it's clear that there's a couple of percentage points there above GDP that we need to bend down. And even if you decreased it by, 0.5% or 1%, you'd be talking about hundreds of billions or trillions of dollars. So there's more than enough money there to pay for what we all want to do in increasing coverage to people. And if you just look at the exercise we have in front of us now with the Congress, there's plenty of scorable savings in the federal budget, and also things that we can do to change the delivery system and to move towards smarter care that we think will produce the kind of savings we need to fund this. And as you said, the president did put on the table also a revenue change. We're in discussions with Congress about that right now. So I'm confident there will be savings enough and the right mix of savings and revenue to pay for this.
We're in the last quarter, to use a sports metaphor that doesn't fit the baseball season. So let's get a few more questions out, and then certainly we want to offer Nancy Ann the opportunity to make whatever final comments she wants to make. And we'll go way in the far end because we haven't been to the far end.
Thank you. Good morning. Okay. Hello? Yes, hi. Chris Silva, American Medical News. There's been some concerns about a shortage of primary care physicians, particularly in the country. Too many specialty services, but not enough primary care services. Some groups have raised concerns about that. I believe MedPAC may have tried to address that within Medicare by proposing some shifts from specialty services towards primary care. Some recommendations have come up about possibly incentivizing better for medical students. Does the administration have any comment on that at all?
Well, it is something that I heard about around the country when I was attending the regional forums, and it's something that we know is on the horizon. There is a shortage of workforce for healthcare, and it's not just physicians. It is primary care physicians, as you said, but it's also other allied health professionals, nurses, certainly, technicians. And to your question about medical home, there's maybe a new type of worker that we need who's helping to manage patients, and we haven't had that before. So there will be a need for more of them. The president's budget, or the president's Economic Recovery Act that he worked with Congress on, included a $500 million investment in the healthcare workforce, especially for healthcare service, healthcare shortage locations, to get the National Health Service Corps clinicians out there. So it's something that we recognize. I don't have any announcements to make about proposals there right now, but we are working with the Congress on that as well.
Okay, way in the back.
Hi, Bertha Coons with CNBC. Mine is sort of a follow-on in that people always concentrate on winning the war. How do you win the peace if you suddenly get 45 million people who have access to health care? How do you contend with that increased demand? In Massachusetts, we've seen very long waits with people unable to get into access to health care because all of a sudden, you have higher utilization rates.
Well, we know that there's a mismatch in our country. There are areas where there are probably more clinicians and more services than we need, and some areas where there are fewer. And everyone's seen the maps that the Dartmouth Athlas has done about both the supply and also the volume and intensity of services that are provided. So there's some things there that we need to work on together. Your question, though, poses a high-class problem, because I'll be excited to work with my colleagues here when we get this bill done and we're working on implementing it and dealing with the problem of having people going to the doctor who haven't been able to before, and that'll be great. But I do think we need to make some investments. That's one reason why the President's Economic Recovery Act did make a down payment in trying to improve the healthcare workforce situation to make sure there are enough clinicians out there to serve these people. It could result in some extra costs. And as I said, we made a down payment on it. You know, one thing that's instructive here is I've looked back at when Medicare was started in 1965 and 66, and there was a big worry at that time. It was July of 1966 that people actually were going to be going the first time to with their Medicare cards. And it was actually 4th of July, I think. The administration then, the Johnson administration, was very worried about what if all of these seniors show up at the hospital and we don't have enough people to care for them? And in fact, that isn't what happened. People were more, it was a more normal situation. It wasn't a situation where hospitals were flooded. So I'm sure when we get to that point, we'll have a newsmaker breakfast and talk about how we're going to deal with it. But at this point, I don't think that it's going to be quite the dire situation.
We're going to take two more questions, and that's because that's all we have time for. Oh, my God.
There's a lot of ways to save money on Medicare, and MedPAC recommended. I'm Sue Darcy from the Gray Sheet. My readers are medical device companies. There's been two ways to save money in Medicare recommended by MedPAC. One is the competitive bidding program for durable medical equipment. And the other one is changing the way imaging is calculated so that imaging payments would be less under Medicare, but Congress keeps fighting back on those, particularly the competitive bidding program. They delayed it last year. What would you do to persuade Congress that these sort of cost savings have to go forward?
Well, I don't have all the details, Sue, about those two items. Again, I don't run the Medicare program anymore, but I will say this. Competitive bidding isn't just something that MedPAC recommended. It's something that was recommended 12 years ago. Well, not recommended. It was enacted into law 12 years ago by Congress. The demos were originally in competitive bidding. In fact, I did those demos in durable medical equipment. And my observation is that those demos were successful, but they're quite different than what I think was going on last year with competitive pricing for medical equipment. And that may be why Congress decided it didn't like what it saw. So obviously the answer here is to work with Congress, and that's what we'll do. But they were convinced, they've been convinced before that a more competitive marketplace for durable medical equipment is the right way to move forward. And I think there is a way to do that and to meet them halfway.
I think everyone thinks you permanently run the Medicare program. And our last question.
Janet Adamy from the Wall Street Journal. You talked about addressing the concerns of small businesses. Can you tell me a little bit about how you've been working with large companies and large employers to address their concerns about keeping their health care costs down?
Well, I've only been there a month, but I have met with a number of representatives of large businesses. And frankly, a lot of them have reached out to me and to the White House to say, we really need to get something done here. We support shared responsibility. We're willing to work with you on moving forward and trying to get health care reform done. They've asked how they can be helpful. I've met with the Chamber of Commerce, and they, too, have said, you know, they represent a lot of large businesses as well as some small businesses, and they've said they want to work with us. So, you know, so far, I think we're seeing a lot of support from large businesses. They too, are very worried about how they're going to lower costs. They're seeing this as a competitiveness problem for them versus their counterparts in other countries. It's hard for them to stay competitive when costs keep going up. So they want to work with us on some of the ideas to bend the curve, to change the delivery system as we move forward with covering everyone. And they all support the president's principles.
Nancy, would you like to make a final comment?
Yes, I'd just like to say that it's exciting to me to be back working on what I think is one of the most important problems that our country faces. And I'm going to be back here to fill in those question marks on Drew's chart and say that we were successful in getting this done this year. And as I go out in the country and talk to patients and clinicians about what they want to see changed, it's quite clear that they want to see a better healthcare system where physicians can treat their patients in a smarter way, get them the care that they need, patients want to have stability with respect to their costs, and so do small businesses. And I think all of this is within our grasp. I think we can get everybody covered, and we can lower costs. And I can tell from the way we're working with Congress that they're very committed to the same goals.
Thank you all for showing so much interest in this morning's breakfast, and good luck to you in your extraordinary assignment.
Thank you.